Hello, and welcome to our podcast. Today, we will be talking about the types of pre-tax plans which exist to help employees pay for out-of-pocket medical, dental, and vision expenses on a pre-tax basis. Today's guest is Rich Miller, president of the Harrison Group, one of our trusted third-party administration partners. Rich is a CPA and has been working with pre-tax plans for the last 30 years. The Harrison Group has approximately 1,000 clients within the United States. Rich will be speaking about flexible spending accounts, health reimbursement arrangements, and health savings accounts. So welcome to our podcast, Rich.
Hi, Shelley. How are you today?
I really appreciate
the opportunity to have a conversation with you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And I'm going to begin my questions with, which employees can participate in these plans that we were talking about, the FSAs, the HRAs, and the HSAs?
Well, Shelley, we get these types of questions all the time, and sometimes from the same people multiple times during a year. So the simple answer is that if you're a W-2 employee and you've worked with an employer for a certain period of time, depending upon the plan document, you're really eligible to participate in these types of plans. But not included in this group are sole proprietors, although a sole proprietor can have a plan and then their employees participate, partners in a partnership, members of a limited liability company, and members are really the people that own the limited liability company, immediate family members of the members of a limited liability company or partnership can participate. So it's okay if, let's say, you're married and your spouse is an employee, that your spouse could participate in the plan. And then we've got more than 2% owners and their immediate family members of an S-Corp. And that's the one that we get the most confusion about, because it not only includes the employees, but also their spouses, their children, their grandchildren, and their parents. So it's very restrictive for anybody that owns more than 2% of an S corporation.
You definitely hit the high points there and the things that are questioned most often. So my next question for you is, although healthcare flexible spending accounts have been around for many, many years, can you say a few things about the flexible spending account?
Absolutely. So a healthcare flexible spending account can be established with any type of group medical plan. It doesn't matter whether it's a copay plan or whether it's an HSA compatible plan. If you have a group medical plan, then employees can contribute to a healthcare FSA, which also means that if you do not have a group medical plan, then your employees cannot participate in a healthcare flexible spending account. The eligible expenses for the healthcare FSA include allowable medical, dental, and vision expenses. And I mention allowable because there's some expenses that aren't allowable, such as cosmetic surgery that did not result in some sort of a non-health incident. Like, for instance, if somebody had some sort of a health issue that required reconstructive surgery, that would be an eligible expense. And expenses can be reimbursed for not only their employees, but their spouse and their family members up to age 26. And with children up to age 26, they don't have to be a full-time student and they don't have to be tax dependents of the employee. They just need to be less than age 26. Healthcare FSAs also allow for both employer contributions and employee contributions. But in most cases, the healthcare FSA should limit any employer contributions to no more than $500 per employee. There are some exceptions, but it's probably a little bit too in detail for our discussion today. For the healthcare FSA, you can't vary employer contributions by class of employee. So you couldn't say, okay, we're going to take all supervisors and make them eligible for a healthcare FSA and then have all the rest of employees not eligible for it. The plan can provide for up to a $500 carryover. So to give you an example, let's suppose there's a $500 carryover provision. If somebody had $300 at the end of the plan year left in their flexible spending account, then they could carry that amount over. And the annual limit for the healthcare FSA for 2019 is projected to be $2,700. In fact, probably within the next week, that's going to be it's going to be disclosed as to whether that's going to be it, but I'm pretty sure it will be. And the carryover amount is in addition to the $2,700. So if you had $500 left in your healthcare FSA at the end of the plan year and you wanted to do the maximum for next year, you could actually be reimbursed for $3,200 of expenses for the plan year next year. Depending upon the employer's plan design, the plan could also provide for a grace period, but you can't have a grace period and a $500 carryover in the same year. You could, however, have a grace period and then later on in the year say, you know what, we're going to switch over and we're going to make it a $500 carryover. And typically the grace period's a period of time up to 2.5 months after the plan year end that participants have to incur eligible expenses.
Well, thank you for all those details, Rich. I think you hit the really high points about the flexible spending account and the questions that are often asked. I know a second part about the flexible spending accounts relates to dependent daycare. So could you give me some information about setting up a dependent daycare flexible spending account?
Absolutely. So dependent daycare FSA, and you notice how I said dependent daycare, because you could not only have children, but you could also have parents that are in daycare, and you can pay for those expenses pre-tax through a flexible spending account. The expenses have to be, however, as I just mentioned, for a qualifying dependent. So let's suppose that you had somebody that was a parent where you were taking care of their expenses for daycare. If you can't pay for their expenses or you can't claim them as a dependent, then those expenses wouldn't qualify for the dependent daycare. Children must be under age, under 12 years of age, and the expenses must be reported to a caregiver. So you could actually have a nanny that's taking care of the child, but that nanny would need to be reporting the income that you're paying him or her. Expenses can be reimbursed to the extent that amounts are withheld from employees' paychecks. So that's really probably the only negative with the daycare flexible spending account, because sometimes what happens is people have to pay the daycare and then they have to have the amount withheld from their paychecks, or they can use their debit card or submit a manual claim for reimbursement. And the other thing is that if you use the daycare flexible spending account, you're not eligible for the child care credit for the same expenses. Now, people say, well, which one should I do? The rule of thumb has always been that if your family income exceeds $25,000, then it's best to do the daycare flexible spending account. But if it's less than $25,000, then what will happen is you're probably better off taking the child care credit. The other thing that sometimes people get caught by is that the allowable amount is to the extent that the spouse earning the lesser amount income, it's limited to. So I'm not sure I explained that correctly, but I'll try it again. So what happens is, let's say that you had a spouse earning $3,000 and the child was in daycare. The most that you could put into a daycare flexible spending account would be $3,000. It's limited to $5,000 or the earnings of the spouse that earns less. But then there's also a provision that if the spouse is totally disabled or is a full-time student, there's an exception that you could put up to the entire $5,000.
Well, thank you for that information. And I'm going to switch gears on you now. Can we talk a little bit about health savings accounts? They've become much more popular over the last 15 to 20 years. They're in the news a lot now with all the changes that have been happening related to the Affordable Health Care and the Trump administration. So could you go into some more details about an HSA, a health savings account?
Absolutely. I have a question and answer book on HSAs that have probably close to 1,000 questions and answers in it. So for today's podcast, we're not going to really address all of those questions, but we'll hit some of the high points. So if an employer has a qualifying HSA-compatible medical insurance plan, then employees can establish health savings account through their company. And so the key is that it has to be an HSA-compatible plan. So if you have a plan that has copays, it let's say medical or for prescription drugs, it's not going to be an HSA compatible plan. So the first thing that we need to always remember is make sure it's an HSA compatible plan. And the health savings account contributions are limited to the annual maximum established by the Internal Revenue Service. And they can be any combination of employer and employee contributions. And the HSA contributions allowable for 2019 is $3,500 for single participants and $7,000 for those participants that have one or more family members covered under their plan. There's also a provision for the employee and the spouse, if they're at least 55 years of age, they can each put in $1,000. But the thing you want to make sure of is that if you have a spouse that wants to put in $1,000, it's got to be put into his or her HSA. It can't be put into the employee's HSA. For health savings account contributions outside of a cafeteria plan, there's something called the comparability rule, and that means that what you give to one, you give to all in the same situation. So you could give $500 to everybody that has single coverage and $1,000 for somebody that has family coverage. However, you can't vary it by, let's say, job classification or because you want to be nicer to some employees than others. It doesn't work that way. So for health savings accounts, employer contributions inside of a cafeteria plan, contributions can vary as long as the employer can pass the 25% concentration test, which is one of the tests that typically are performed on a cafeteria plan. So you might say, what the heck are contributions inside of a cafeteria plan? Probably the easiest way to describe that is that if the contributions allow for employees to take a cash option, then it's inside the plan. And if it's just you can get a contribution to your HSA and that's all your option is, it's outside of one. And it matters because you could vary your contributions if it's inside one. If employees contribute to a health savings account, the employer can establish a limited purpose healthcare FSA. And the key portion there is that an employee can't have both an HSA and a regular healthcare FSA. The limited purpose healthcare FSA provides for reimbursement for dental, vision, and wellness expenses. Some HSAs permit employees to invest a portion of their funds in various mutual funds. Our arrangement that we have where we have our clients have their employees' money go in allows for employees to invest their balance in excess of $2,000 in various no-load funds. And we have approximately 30 funds available to participants. And as I say, they're no-load, and they all have a little bit different investment objective. So it's a good thing for people that build up a balance in their HSAs that they don't need to pay for current expenses. And of course, we have a money market account where if people don't want to invest their money, it generates a little bit of interest income. But with interest rates being so low, that amount isn't that great.
Right.
But it's better than nothing.
Right.
Once an employer contributes or an employee contributes to their HSA, the employee has complete control over the funds. The employer has no access to view what's in their account, what they've spent their money on, or anything else. So it's sometimes we get employers that say, oh, well, why don't you tell me how people are spending their money so we can design the plan next year to accommodate what expenses they have. And we're really not allowed to disclose that. Also, if the employer doesn't maintain an HSA medical plan, it could provide for employee contributions to an HSA. If, let's say, the employee's spouse is participating in a high deductible plan and the spouse is contributing some, but the employee wants to contribute some, as long as the plan document allows for it, it's okay to do it that way. And one last thing about that is that you could have an HSA plan that, and sometimes people call it an HSA plan. There's a medical plan that's an HSA compatible plan, and then there's a thing called a health savings account where money's going into it. And you could design your plan to just allow for employee contributions only, or you could also provide that the employer contributes as well as the employee. And once again, I can't stress enough that whenever that money goes into that HSA, it's gone. And so if you have people where they have no medical expenses and the employer's contributing to an HSA, they just build up a savings account like that. And if they leave the company, they take the money with them.
You make some good points there and information that we all need as we're getting those high deductible plans and considering setting up those health savings accounts. So these are some real helpful tips for employers and employees to know how to spend that money. Can you give me maybe an example of what not to do with a health savings account?
Well, unfortunately, we've seen a couple situations where people kind of goofed. And the first one was where the client had a $2,500, $5,000 deductible HSA compatible plan. And so they were advised, unfortunately, by their broker to have the HRA reimburse the first part of the deductible, and then the health savings account contributions would go in after those contributions were made. And unfortunately, they got an opinion from their current law firm as well as another national firm who said, yeah, that was okay. And it really happened when we got the client, or when I had my initial meeting with the client. And so I had to get involved with a discussion that, no, this isn't allowable. And so then they called the law firm up and said, all right, so what's the deal? Can we do this? This isn't what this TPA is telling me. And they kind of matter-of-factly said, yeah, it's okay. It really isn't an allowable way. So you'll probably have to fix your plan. Well, fixing the plan meant that all the employees had to take withdrawals from the HSAs, report any contributions back as income, and then there were withdrawal penalties from where they had the money invested. And then luckily, we got that done prior to the due date of the individual's tax return, so there were no IRS penalties. The other example was where we had a broker where what they did was they had, I think it was a $2,000, $4,000 deductible plan, and the broker looked at it and said, well, that's kind of a high deductible plan. We'll do HSAs. Well, unfortunately, there were co-pays with the plan, which meant that it was not an HSA-compatible plan. And so what happened was the broker went to the client and did all the enrollment meetings, and then afterwards had to explain that, no, they couldn't do it that way. And unfortunately, what happened was that the client went to somebody else after that. So you just need to be careful when you have a medical plan to make sure that the medical plan's an allowable medical plan to contribute to a health savings account.
Well, those are definitely some curious incidents, and I'm thank you for sharing those with us. We've talked about FSA, we talked about flexible spending accounts. Can we spend a little bit of time talking about HRAs or health reimbursement arrangements?
Definitely. Now, this is a subject that I could probably talk about for days and days and days, and obviously nobody has the time commitment for that. However, HRAs only allow employer contributions. So if you have a plan where you say, yeah, we want the employees to contribute to it, that's not an HRA. You can't do it. And in fact, I just had the question this morning, well, what's the difference between a MERP and an HRA? And, you know, a MERP existed for many years, and then they came up with an HRA. And really the only difference between the two of them is that an HRA has a provision that you could potentially carry over contributions from one year to the next if you wanted to provide for that. But most plans don't do that. Most plans, you basically get reimbursed for expenses during the year, and if at the end of the year you don't spend your money, then you get nothing back, or you can't carry it over.
Right.
And there's no limits on the annual contribution, so you could have, let's say that you had a plan where the out-of-pocket was $15,000. You could reimburse up to $15,000, and we're going to talk a little bit about how the health insurance company would approach that in a couple of minutes, but it's something that we do have plans that reimburse 100% of what the deductible is or 100% of the out-of-pocket. And there are many, many, many different types of HRAs. So when people say, well, what can we do? Well, an HRA typically will reimburse medical, dental, and or vision expenses, but you could limit it, the plan, to paying for doctor visits on odd Thursdays in July if you wanted to. I don't know that we've ever had it designed that way, but if you wanted to, you could do it. And the actual experience you get under the HRA really varies based upon age of employees, their health, and several other factors. So when people say, well, what kind of an experience are we going to get from this particular plan, we can kind of make a guess. Let's say you had a $3,000, $6,000 deductible plan, you could probably figure that it's going to be about maybe 60% of the maximum that employees have available to them from the deductible. But the only thing is, it depends on the health of the group. We've had it where there have been really healthy groups, and it's only been, let's say, 30% or 40%, and we've had it as high as 65%. Most HRAs have an annual maximum per employee, and the reason why they do that is that the employer goes with a medical plan where it either keeps the premiums the same or provides a decrease in those premiums. And when they do that, they want to be sure that they don't end up increasing the cost of the plan. So almost every single one of them have a cap per employee. And then the types of HRAs we see, our software provider has 4,000 different configurations of HRAs.
Oh, so, my gosh.
So if you were laying awake at night, not that you'd ever do this, but if you were and you were thinking about, well, maybe we could do this, chances are you can. But we have HRAs where the employer reimburses the first part of the deductible, the last part. The first part's paid by the employee, the second part's paid by the employer, and the last part is on the employee. We have them where the employer reimburses the in-hospital deductible and outpatient surgery, all of it, a part of it, the first part on the employee, the last part on the employer. We have them where there's the plan reimburses a percentage of prescription drugs. I kind of think that's a neat little idea because, you know, if you have problems getting the employer's employees to go to generic costs, what you could do is, or generic brands, what you could do is you could allow for a debit card to pay for a percent of the prescription drug cost, and then maybe employees would look at it and say, well, geez, if I go to the the brand name drug is going to cost me more out of pocket, so maybe they'll be more inclined to go to the generic.
Right.
We can also reimburse the difference in copays. We can also reimburse amounts subject to the deductible, less certain copay amounts that they want to build in. But when you do those types of plans, you may limit the efficiency of a debit card, although we have them where they've been using one. And then we have plans that reimburse in-network only and both in and out of network. So we have them all over the place. If you ever had a question of whether you can do it, if you contacted us, we could probably tell you. But chances are your imagination will be satisfied by some sort of an alternative that we come up with. Now, one of the other things, or the last thing about this HRA is, or two things, is that employers can be provided with the total dollar usage, and it can be by employee, but it can't be specifically on what they actually pay out of their pocket, like, let's say, doctor visits or certain prescriptions and that kind of thing. And the last thing is that employees must be a participant in a group medical plan in order to participate in the employer's HRA. So you could have something that just says, we're going to reimburse medical, dental, and vision costs that are out of pocket for the employee, and they could be on their spouse's medical plan. As long as they're in a group medical plan, they're okay.
And one last question for today's podcast. We've talked about health savings accounts and health reimbursement arrangements. So is there a way to combine the two? Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So what happens with combining, let's say, an HRA with an HSA, what you could do is you could configure the HRA to pay for, it's called a post-deductible HRA. And what happens for plan years beginning in 2018 and 19, the minimum annual deductible for employees with single coverage is $1,350 and $2,700 for employees with coverage with at least one covered family member. So what happens is, let's take a single person, and let's say there's a $3,000 deductible. The first $1,350 would need to be paid either on their own by the employee, but or through an HSA that the employee sets up. And after the employee has had the responsibility to pay the $1,350, the next $1,650 could be paid through the HRA. And that's perfectly allowable. And we have a lot of clients that do that, where the first portion goes into an HSA or they just don't participate in an HSA, and then the HRA kicks in after at least $1,350 or $2,700. When offering this type of a plan from one year to the next, what happens is some people say, all right, well, what we're going to do, it used to be $1,300 and $2,600, what they would have done is said, okay, fine, let's just keep the plan the same way. And the next year it went to $1,350 and $2,700, which would have meant that they weren't in compliance. So it's important to make sure things get updated correctly.
Right. Well, Rich, thank you for all this wealth of information. It's been really good. Would you join us next month for additional details, because there's a lot of things we have yet to cover that we didn't have the time to go over. So would you join us next month?
I'd be happy to, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thank you, Rich. If you'd like additional information or have questions about some of the information contained in this podcast, feel free to give Rich a call at 610-853-9075 or email at rmiller@theharrisongrouponline.com. This podcast is designed to highlight various employee benefit matters of general interest to our listeners. It is not intended to interpret laws or regulations or to address specific client situations. You should not act or rely on any information contained herein without seeking the advice of an attorney or a tax professional. We hope you found this podcast helpful and informative. If you have any questions, please contact your account manager or salesperson. Thank you.